This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, the 23rd of May, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. After pleading the fifth for 2 months, former top advisor for Alberto Gonzalez, Monica Goodling, testifies before the House Judiciary Committee. As Israel threatens to assassinate Hamas leaders, Fatah and Hamas plan a renewed strategy for an end to the Palestinian internal conflict. And Amnesty International releases its annual report, citing the worldwide erosion of human rights. But first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. The Democratic leadership in Congress has capitulated to the White House demand for a war funding bill without a timetable for withdrawal from Iraq. The move comes after President Bush vetoed legislation that would have required a phased pullout to begin on October 1st and congressional approval of progress reports in order to obtain further funding. Some House Democrats say they will vote against the war spending measure in the absence of a timeline. Representatives plan to remove domestic spending measures from the war funding bill in order to hold two separate votes tomorrow. U.S. taxpayers have already spent an estimated $500 billion on the war. Several hundred anti-war protesters rallied outside of the Coast Guard Academy in New London, Connecticut this morning as President Bush was speaking to graduates inside the gates. Melinda Tuhus reports.
Calls for impeachment of Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney and for an end to torture mingled with the overriding demand to bring the troops home from Iraq. One of the speakers at the rally was veteran Ted Goodnight, who fought in Afghanistan. He said after the war in Iraq started, American soldiers fighting in Afghanistan found themselves short of equipment, which was going to Iraq.
Iraq didn't attack us. So why were our resources given the priority of Iraq and not Al-Qaeda, not bin Laden?
Meanwhile, in his speech, Bush said Al-Qaeda had grown in Iraq and must be targeted for destruction. Anti-war forces agree that Al-Qaeda is now in Iraq as a direct result of the U.S. invasion there. A smaller group of pro-Bush demonstrators took up positions across the street, often shouting commie at the anti-war throngs, while the latter screamed back bigot and fascist. It was not a day for changing any minds. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New London, Connecticut.
Two U.S. aircraft carriers and seven battleships are patrolling off the coast of Iran in what the Pentagon calls a security exercise. It is the largest daytime show of U.S. naval force in the Persian Gulf since the start of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. The nine warships are reportedly carrying 17,000 crew members and 140 aircraft. The government of Iran had not received prior notification of the exercise. The buildup comes as the International Atomic Energy Agency has issued a report highlighting Iran's expanded practice of uranium enrichment, despite UN Security Council demands to stop the program. Sanctions have already been imposed on Iran, and the Security Council could meet in the coming days to discuss further punitive measures. Amendments to the immigration bill now under consideration in the Senate could mandate prison time for people who cross the U.S. border illegally. FSRN's Renee Feltz has more.
The give and take debate now underway in the U.S. Senate will include several amendments to the immigration reform legislation on the table. These changes will allow lawmakers to shape the bill in response to criticism. For Republicans, critics are mostly from core supporters on the far right. So far, the temporary worker program has been the focus of overhaul efforts. Now, in response to complaints the bill is too lenient, South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham is emphasizing its security enforcement measures.
Before 9/11, I would argue that illegal immigration was a social and economic problem. After 9/11, I would argue it's a national security problem. We have millions of people in our country roaming around. We don't know who they are and what they're up to.
Today, Senator Graham is set to offer an amendment to require mandatory prison sentences for people who cross into the U.S. illegally. The wording of the bill already mandates more than 27,000 new detention or prison spaces along the borders. Under current enforcement measures, more than 32,000 immigrants are projected to be in detention this summer. Debate on immigration continues this week. A vote on the bill is expected in June. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Renee Feltz.
A former administrative assistant at Coca-Cola's Atlanta headquarters received an 8-year prison sentence today for planning to steal secret documents and sell them to Pepsi. Joya Williams was charged last year along with two other men. One of the co-accused has already been sentenced to 5 years in prison. The three were outed by PepsiCo, which cooperated with the FBI's investigation. And finally, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg has announced that all of the city's 13,000 taxis will have hybrid engines by the year 2012. The mayor says the policy will reduce the city's carbon emissions by over half in the next 10 years. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News. She pleaded the fifth for 2 months, but today Monica Goodling had to testify. As a former White House liaison for the Justice Department and as a former top advisor for Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, Goodling is one of the last Justice Department officials to testify before the House Judiciary Committee on the firing of U.S. prosecutors and on which she and the White House knew. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
During the hearing, Goodling was questioned on perceived inconsistencies in the testimony of other department officials about her involvement. Last month, former Deputy Attorney General Paul McNulty said that Goodling had withheld information prior to his testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Goodling says this is not the case.
The allegation is false. I did not withhold information from the deputy. To the contrary, I worked diligently to compile and provide the deputy with dozens of pages of statistics and other information that I thought he was likely to need based on the questions that were being asked at that time. Despite my and others' best efforts, the deputy's public testimony was incomplete or inaccurate in a number of respects. As explained in more detail in my written remarks, I believe the deputy was not fully candid about his knowledge of White House involvement in the replacement decision.
Goodling also testified that during her time at the Justice Department, she interviewed job applicants and at times did consider their political affiliations.
In every case, I tried to act in good faith and for the purpose of ensuring that the department was staffed by well-qualified individuals who were supportive of the Attorney General's views, priorities, and goals. Nevertheless, I do acknowledge that I may have gone too far in asking political questions of applicants for career positions, and I may have taken inappropriate political considerations into account on some occasions, and I regret those mistakes.
During the hearing, Representative Daryl Issa, Republican from California, said the committee should not be surprised that politics was involved in the decisions.
Isn't it, in fact, absolutely the right of a president elected by the American people to choose people who will support his policies? And that, in fact, when you did that, you were doing what was your right, and when you chose not to was actually the exception that should be noted here today.
I think presidents of both parties have the right to pick the people to serve them.
Today's testimony from Goodling comes after months of inquiry from the House Judiciary Committee on possible improper politicizing in the Justice Department. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, Deputy Attorney General Paul McNulty, and other top aides have already testified. But Chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Congressman John Conyers, says Goodling's testimony is still needed and there may be others.
I would hope that the fact of her testimony would encourage others to come forward and cooperate with our inquiry. And that includes personnel in the White House itself, whose role in these firings appear to grow more central every day. Every time another Department of Justice official denies recommending putting any particular prosecutor on the firing list. We cannot trust the Department of Justice to fairly and impartially enforce our nation's laws if we cannot trust the testimony of our most senior officials in the administration, if it appears that the U.S. attorneys are merely pawns in a game of politics, then we will have suffered the loss of one of our nation's most fundamental principles, the rule of law.
The committee is considering issuing subpoenas for other White House officials. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas of Fatah and Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh of Hamas agreed Wednesday to a joint strategy to reinforce a fifth Hamas-Fatah ceasefire in a week as Israeli military attacks continue on the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, Israel has threatened to assassinate Hamas leaders, including Haniyeh himself. FSRN's Rami Al-Megari has more.
For the first time since last November, Israeli army has been attacking the Gaza Strip heavily for the past week. Israel says its attacks on Gaza are a response to how Hamas, and other resistance groups have been firing on nearby Israeli towns. Israeli media reports say that the United States is backing the President Abbas al-Fadeh against the governing Hamas in light of recent U.S. financial and logistic support to Abbas. Sergio Yanni is an Israeli political analyst.
The current attacks are part of an attempt to overthrow physically the Palestinian elected government, to put Dahlan as the next government of the Palestinian entity. The idea is that Dahlan will accept, and actually he will accept, the Israeli plan of separation, the American plans for the Middle East, as the future. It's not at all about moderates or radicals.
Israeli Defense Minister Amir Peretz asserted yesterday that Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh may be a target for future Israeli attacks unless homemade rockets fire comes to a halt. According to estimates, hundreds of homemade shells have been fired by Hamas and other groups into Israel since 2002. In response, Israel intervened militarily in the coastal region. The latest Israeli offensive was last year's so-called summer rains, in which about 450 Palestinian men, women, and children were killed and the gross damage was inflicted on buildings and other infrastructure. The current attacks coincide with intermittent Hamas Fatah infighting. Abdul Hakim Awad is a spokesman of Fatah in Gaza.
When the United States claims it is backing the Presidential Guard, it is not actually providing anything, but rather causing a great harm to the Fatah movement and President Mahmoud Abbas.
Asked by FSRN as to what impact the Israeli attacks might leave on the Palestinian situation, Awad says,
in case Israel launches a ground offensive on Gaza, it will face a unified Palestinian resistance of Fatah, Hamas, the Popular Front, and others.
Hamas denies the infighting is against Fatah. Khalil Abu Layla is a political leader of Hamas.
The internal Palestinian infighting has not been between the Islamic movement of Hamas and Fatah. Rather, it has been initiated by a Zionist, Israeli, American-backed group for the purpose of creating the so-called creative chaos in the Palestinian arena, so that the United States of America can achieve its goals. Israel can weaken the armed wing of Hamas by directing its capacity to infighting within that group, all of which is being instructed by the Zionists.
The internationally quartered United States, United Nations, European Union, and Russia, along with Israel, has been demanding the governing Hamas to recognize Israel, renounce violence, and accept past signed agreements since Hamas came to power in January 2006 elections. For Free Speech Radio News and IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Megari in Gaza.
In Sri Lanka, fighting rages between the government forces and the rebels known as the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, or LTTE. Heavy losses of life are reported on both sides, and civilians are longing for a peaceful settlement despite no hopeful signs for peace talks. FSRN's Paniya Manikavasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
The main marketplace in northern border town of Vaunia that separates the rebel-held territory and the government-controlled area. Traders here say the situation is tense with fighting between the rebels and the government forces taking place 15 to 20 kilometers away. P.S. Abdullah is a prominent trader in the town.
The border area.
Fighting is going on in the border about 15 kilometers away from here. People live in fear. They are suffering. There's no proper transport. Prices have gone up. War is going on. And there is heavy loss of life on both sides. Civilians are displaced in big numbers, and we are living under a trying situation. We don't want war. We hate the war. The government and the LTTE should come to an agreement. They must sit down and talk to find a solution.
But the Tamil Tiger rebels have said they will not return to peace talks unless the government halts the military campaign against them. President Mahinda Rajapaksa this week said his country is working hard to defeat terrorism and liberate the people from the clutch of the rebels. SP Tamil Chelvan, the rebel political leader in the northern stronghold of Kilinochi, says the government is trying to present the military campaign as part of the war on terror to win international support. The rebels are fighting for a separate state for the minority ethnic Tamils, saying the majority Sinhalese discriminate against them. Ethnic Tamils make up less than a fifth of the 20 million person population. The guerrillas took the conflict to a new level in March by introducing their light-winged attack aircraft to target government military installations near capital Colombo. Rebel air raids forced the government to close the only international airport during the nights. It has created an insecure feeling among the people living outside of the northeastern region of war theater. Tourism, stock markets, and other trades were badly affected. The rebels have suffered territorial losses in the east since fighting escalated in January this year, and the government has started offensives in the north. Brigadier Prasad Samarasinghe is the military spokesman. He said the army liberated more than 150,000 civilians in the east by neutralizing the guns of the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, the LTTE.
Forces started countering and neutralizing the LTTE attacks ahead of the forward defense lines and in and around Vaunia, Omante, Mena side in January. Since January, 545 LTTE cadres were killed up to yesterday and troops also suffered in 45 now. In those areas, troops are neutralizing and troops are continuing the operations to minimize the threat from LTTE.
But Rasiya Ilandrayan, the rebel spokesman, disputed the loss, saying the count of the government is political and military propaganda to mislead the people in the south.
The Tamil Nadu Air Force attacks on their strategical points has barely damaged the image of the military leaders, and it has created questions about the military's inability to at least reduce the threat of being attacked again. Therefore, they are wildly exaggerating the figures of the loss on our side. According to records, we suffered only between 60 and 65 for the past 4 months.
President Mahinda Rajapaksa had arranged for an all-party conference to put forward a proposal to solve the ethnic issue. Rajapaksa's Sri Lanka Freedom Party this month offered a district-level system of decentralization of power. The rebels rejected it, saying the proposal is the same as one rejected by the Tamils 30 years ago. Murugesu Sitambalam is the senior lawyer and a former moderate Tamil politician. He was then the chairman of the failed district council for Vaunia district in the 1980s.
Had the government been keen to give the district council then, more powers, the district council might have succeeded then, after a total failure of two administrative setups. Now to think about district council again is fantasy. It can never work. My feeling is the Tamils will never accept anything less than a merged northeast with sufficient powers to rule themselves, like what you find in a federal constitution.
Tamil Chelvan, the rebel political leader, said the rebels will not go to the negotiating table in a position of political and military weakness amid clashes between the government forces and the rebel fighters across the island's northeast. Analysts fear the Sri Lankan conflict that has killed nearly 70,000 people since 1983 could rage on for years. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiya Manikavasagam from Vaunia, Sri Lanka.
The British government published a controversial energy review paper today, which confirms yet another five-month consultation will begin over the government's wish to build a new generation of nuclear power stations across the country. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
The state of British energy has been reviewed and re-reviewed. The government's first consultation was supposed to ask the public and interested groups for their views on nuclear power. But it was so farcical, a High Court judge ruled that it was seriously flawed, misleading, and manifestly inadequate and unfair. The government has no choice but to hold the whole consultation process again. But that court ruling didn't seem to alter the government's views on the subject. This was Tony Blair's reaction at the time.
This won't affect the policy at all.
I mean, it will affect the process of consultation, but it won't affect the policy. And the reason why I believe that it's important that we have nuclear power back on the agenda is because if we don't replace the existing nuclear power stations, then I cannot see how we're going to meet our climate change targets.
So nuclear power is being presented as a green option. And with Britain's own oil and gas resources dwindling, security of supply is also top of government concerns. But Greenpeace is opposed to nuclear power as expensive and dirty. It was behind the judicial review that forced a repeat public consultation. So does Greenpeace expect this second run to be any fairer? Ben Elise.
Certainly our lawyers are going to be looking very carefully at developments over the coming months. And if the government fails to carry out a fair consultation, then I'm afraid we're going to see them back in court.
Greenpeace is advocating energy efficiency, investment in renewable energy, and the building of decentralised, ultra-efficient combined heat and power stations as the answers to Britain's energy problems. Ben Elise again.
If ministers and the government go down the nuclear route, they're going to almost kill off the future for new clean energy technologies, certainly the investment and the political support that they need to get off the ground. If you look at places like Finland, where they're building Europe's newest nuclear reactor, the renewable industry in Finland has really withered on the vine and they're already missing their Kyoto obligations. So by taking the nuclear option, really the country is kissing goodbye to its chances of tackling climate change.
A five-month public consultation starts today and ends on the 10th of October. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Authoritative governments and armed factions are provoking fear to wash away human rights around the world. That's a finding of Amnesty International's Report 2007 issued today, which assessed human rights worldwide. 2006 saw major international human rights catastrophes, and in places like Nigeria, struggles for shelter illustrate a trend throughout the African continent to forcibly evict millions of people from their homes. Felix Morka is a lawyer who works to prevent such evictions and says the Nigerian government needs to create housing alternatives.
If you cannot help me make my house better, don't destroy the one that I have made by myself. That's the principle. That's why we continue to fight the government when they try to demolish, you know, the community.
Aside from the issue of mass evictions, Amnesty International says that violent conflicts in 2006 set the stage for displacement around the world. Israel began attacking Lebanon last July after Hezbollah's capture of two Israeli soldiers and killed some 1,000 civilians. Hezbollah retaliated and launched thousands of rockets into northern Israel and killed some 40 civilians. Hundreds of thousands of people were displaced, including young children. One young Lebanese woman explains how her child went hungry as a result of the conflict.
We don't want anything other than well-being. Look at this child. There's no bread or milk. Bread is so expensive now. Isn't that a crime? We don't want war. We don't want trouble.
As the war between Israel and Lebanon raged on, the United Nations took weeks to call for a ceasefire. Amnesty International's report also cites that the United States, which Director Larry Cox says was once a beacon of hope and a leader in justice for human rights defenders, needs to change its own practices and set the international standard for human rights, and adds that continued vague detentions indicate a downward spiral of human rights abuses. In 2003, Mohammed Faraj Bashmila, a Yemeni national, was detained during a brief trip to Jordan and handed over to the United States. He was held in secret U.S. custody for 18 months, completely isolated and cut off from his family, and was never told why he was arrested or charged with any crime. He explained some of the abuses he endured during his 18 months in prison.
And then they covered my eyes and ears with a band-aid and covered it all with a sticking plaster. At that moment, I already could not feel anything anymore because they hit every part of my body. But my mind was thinking, and I just felt or thought that God must have spared me from feeling the pain and suffering. That was one thing. The other thing is that I was wondering how my mama and wife were doing now. Then they dragged us onto a plane, a small plane.
The report says that the United States needs to change its own policies to mend its international credibility. Irene Khan is Amnesty International's Secretary General. She says that there needs to be a renewed sense of human rights internationally.
The erosion of human rights can only be arrested if there is a stronger sense of global solidarity, if there is an end to this politics of fear, a sense that there is real value in human rights, that the world, a fractured world, can be brought together around global values of human rights, around the universality of human rights and the indivisibility of human rights.
Amnesty International's 2007 report calls on the new U.S. Congress to help restore human rights here and abroad.
And now, from his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Chomsky, columnist without a place. For those of us who know the name Noam Chomsky, our familiarity flows from having read or read about his many books on political or foreign affairs. Perhaps his best known are 9/11, Manufacturing Consent, written with Ed Herman, and thanks to the promotion at the UN by Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez, Hegemony or Survival. That said, when or if we think of him, it's in that context, a critic, an author, or a scholar. Who knew that he is a gifted, concise columnist? Chomsky has been writing and distributing his op-ed pieces for years. Unfortunately, American newspapers rarely carry them. In fact, as Chavez has demonstrated, Chomsky's readership of both books and columns may be more plentiful abroad than here in the States. That may change with the publication of his newest book, a collection of his columns called Interventions. Interventions offers over 40 of Chomsky's columns, insightful, crisp, and well-researched pieces on news events of the day. From 9/11 to the Iraq War, from the non-crisis of Social Security to the leveling of Lebanon, Chomsky offers his informed opinion and critical analysis. The real kicker is, why is it easier to read him in Mexico's La Jornada National Daily or Britain's Guardian than, say, The Washington Post or The New York Times? The reasons are simple and undeniable. He doesn't buy the Washington consensus that is the bread and butter of most U.S. newspapers, and his pen slants to the left. In this age, when the nation's mass media knowingly betrayed its customers into this disaster of a war based on a lie, Chomsky's musings could have been a valuable and necessary corrective. Unfortunately, millions of Americans never got that option. Instead, they were fed the lies of privilege, profit, and warmongering that led this nation into the mess it now finds itself. A timely intervention might have changed things. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Free Speech Radio News is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. To find out how you can support FSRN's programming, visit our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Our producers are Monica Lopez and Tina Gysi. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. DC editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado.